Hello, welcome to the discussion group, the TMS Wiki discussion group on, this is 9/10/2013, September 10th, 2013, on a Tuesday night, and we're thankful to be here once again on this hot wave night. I need to go ahead and make the main disclaimer. Before we start, I do need to remind everyone that this is a peer support group. None of us are medical or mental health professionals. Now, as everyone knows, we are reading from The Great Pain Deception by Steve Ozenich. And this week we're on chapter 4, Chasing the Changes, A Time for Reflection. And I like what Bruce said before we got started about all the different triggers. I'm excited to talk about the different triggers and the different conditionings, which I guess those two go together. Well, no, there's a condition, and that's where you're conditioned, and then there's triggers, but we'll speak about that differently. Okay, Bruce, you want to go ahead and give the summary?
Well, today we're going to go over, we're addressing Chapter 4 of Steve Ozenich's The Great Pain Deception, entitled Chasing the Changes, A Time for Reflection. And in this chapter, Steve describes the lessons he learned from the gut-wrenching experience, painful experiences he chronicles in the previous chapter, Chapter 3. And then he goes on to examine various triggers that can set off TMS pain. He addresses right at the start, Steve addresses at the start, the purpose of the pain and, you know, what is TMS pain and why does it exist? He says, looking back, that is on his trials and tribulations in the previous chapter 3 that he lists in chapter 3.
And they were some trials and tribulations.
Yeah, the paralysis of his wife, the death of his father-in-law from leukemia, the disintegration of his marriage, his constant trips to various medical technicians to try and fix what was wrong with him. And he says at the start of chapter 4, looking back, pun fully intended. Yeah, Steve is a very funny fellow. My pain was necessary so that I would have to deal with my unresolved biography. The pain served as what he calls an enforcer. He emphasizes that. During times of great tension, my body was revealing to me through my past physical injuries and natural physical changes that I wasn't happy. He talks about old injury sites and why the pain is located there often. The old injury site is simply a trigger, and that's one of the big subjects of this chapter, triggers. The old injury site is simply a trigger for emotional outpouring, a perfect spot for tension to hide. People expect their knee or back or shoulder or neck to act up because they were once injured there, and so it becomes a haven for energy, for anger, energy, focus. Once again, it is an error in belief. So he says, according to his chapter title here, he says, so chasing the changes is like the snake eating its own tail. As new emotions present themselves to old injuries, which are a history of the entire person. He says that we have a tendency to imitate other people's disorders during periods of psychic stress. And he goes on there to, Steve goes on there to describe the process of symptom substitution, which Dr. Sarno describes rather matter-of-factly, but Steve fleshes out. And he also, Steve also deals with why women are more susceptible to body-mind symptoms. They're more empathetic. They're more sympathetic let's see, what does he say? Women are much more open to the truth, but they also tend to harbor higher anxiety levels because they try to be nicer and tend to care more about more things. So it appears to be a wash. And I know, I think I've gotten in a fight on the forum with someone who was saying, well, where did I hear that women are more susceptible to body-mind symptoms than men? I've heard it all over the place.
I think because
in Steve's book, but in Sarno, in Allen Garden, and
I think the mama thing,
Howard Schubner especially.
Yeah, I believe it's the mother thing, the connection that they get with the children. And then I think at the same time, us men that get it, we've got kind of that same heart, it's like the personality trait of the goodest or the top T personality or the perfectionist. I think, according to John Sarno and Steve-O and all the other TMS guys, women get it more. Ain't that something?
And he said, pain is a way of avoiding underlying tension. He says that people have a bunch of responsibilities, and then they have symptoms, and then they go get imaging and see arthritis or herniations and naively believe their pain is due to these changes. When their lives fully calm down, their pain eases or goes away, which sounds like very much the way it is where people go to PT. They've had a back attack. They go to PT. They slow down. They take their doctor's advice. They get bed rest. What they've done is stop the psychic tension that was driving their symptoms.
Plus, they change in the same old routine too, huh?
Yeah, but I think probably in that case, they have not addressed the underlying reasons for TMS. Because they remain the same. See, I noticed from my own example that in 2001, when my mother died, I had the extreme back attack, which was initiated out running by the pounding. That would be a classic trigger that Steve would point out.
And did you say running by the pounding?
The pounding of my feet.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Initiated the pain in my back, I thought. But it was a trigger because at that point, my emotions had reached the critical threshold point and were about to start pouring out. But since I'd been so good at repressing for years, I continued to push them down, and then they manifested as pain. Well,
wow, Bruce, you got a great understanding of TMS healing. I'm just amazed to listen to you, brother. Go ahead.
At that very moment, I also had quit a contract because they started to mess with me, and I'd lost about 20 grand on the market, and I was out alone the first time in social isolation when the symptoms began to manifest. So, then I go to the doc. The doc sends me to PT, and I work like a fiend on the exercises. Well, it seemed to stay at the same level and gradually improve until I got a big insurance settlement and bought a bicycle. And then in about a month, it had gone away. And I thought that going to PT and working hard was what had cured it. But actually, I was much cheerier. I was much less grim. And that's what Steve is talking about here. When their lives finally calm down, their pain eases or goes away. So what happened? Did their back disc suddenly unherniate? Their rotator cuffs untear? Their torn knee ligaments and arthritic hips magically reconstitute? The answer is that their hidden tension levels lowered. Okay, so my symptoms went away. Things seemed cheery. Then gradually my personality began to heap more and more workloads on myself, more and more impossible demands, pressing and pushing and pushing until I reached that threshold again, and I was running, and I fell, and I just bounced on my butt, just like sliding into third base. It didn't seem like anything. Then over the weeks, the pain began to build. Obviously, I wasn't fixed from PT. I was fixed from the check and having fun, which I wasn't
When you hit like that on your butt, was you focusing in on the physical part of your body?
I was out running because I was trying to dissipate all the stress I had. I had this impossible schedule I'd set for myself of running. You know, I have to run 8 miles a day or else the world is coming to an end.
Yeah.
So I'd be out there pounding. Yeah, and then it comes back because I didn't deal with the underlying stress, the stressors. I had nearly gone the physical route, and that isn't enough. But Steve talks about imitating other people's disorders during periods of psychic stress.
Now, how many times have you seen that, Bruce?
Oh,
gosh.
Yeah, that's... I walk around every day now, and I overhear always these TMS sufferers initiating, saying things that I've heard before in Sarno. There was a guy sitting next to me the other day in the gym, and this guy walked up to him and said, "How's your back?" And I think that's... I want to ask him now whether his back started hurting then, because that's a classic trigger.
That's a classic.
Yeah, where, so, you know, someone walks up to you at work and you've been out of work with back pain, and the first thing they do is walk up to you and they say, "How's your back?" And then the next day, there you are back again.
Perfect trigger.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit about that idea of cognitive dissonance, and I don't know how much that connects with behavioral psychology, but it sounds like it's a term from that.
It does.
Steve says this is acting in a manner that conflicts with how you truly feel inside, where there's that great dissonance, discrepancy between the way you act and the way you really feel.
That's like the shadow we were talking about last week.
Yeah, that is. Steve, we need you here.
You said it perfect, you know. You said it perfect.
And he talks about the problem where discs seem to be injured in imaging studies. And then the patient and the medical establishment ascribe the pain to those spinal abnormalities like bulging herniated disc.
Remember those times? Do you remember those X-rays, Bruce, that the doctors might have showed you from the past and you looked at
it? My old doctor, when I asked for one, for an MRI, he just went silent and didn't do it because he knew.
He
was my mother's doctor for 40 years and my doctor for 40 years. So he knew what was going on. He'd seen enough of these cases in his practice over 40, 50 years to see how this stuff really works. And so he deliberately did not give me an MRI that would not give me that impression that this was the cause for everything, that there was a physical cause. He figured probably that, well, his mother just died, so he's just got to go through this pain right now for a while.
Well, you was blessed. You was blessed because, you know, most of us has to see those abnormalities, and it does something. That's a trigger. It'll turn into a trigger.
Another thing I noticed is at the time of my fall out running, what happened? My old doctor died.
And
I didn't see that at the time. I thought it was just, I fell on the ground, I hit the scar tissue from the herniated disc, and it set off all of this stuff. but the nature of the injury was not sufficient to cause any more. I didn't even have a bruise.
Wow.
If you don't have a bruise, you don't have hematoma. You haven't got blood in the blood. I was thinking all kinds of things like blood in my spine. You know, the brain starts to take off on this stuff.
Have you heard that before? Is that an actual accident?
That's what paralyzed Steve's wife. Remember the hematoma in her spine from the injection? When the doctor said hematoma to me, I started thinking all kinds. Hematoma meant a bruise, you know.
Yeah, and you've done read about it, and you say you've done read about it. You know what that word means, and then they mention it. Man, is that not scary? You thought a million things, like you said, run through your mind, and all of a sudden you start feeling weird things in your body, you know, within minutes.
Oh, I know. I remember when I talked to Steve last week about how that voice will rise up just as you're waking up in the morning, sometime in the wee hours, where it'll start saying, oh, you better get down to the doctor right now, because these symptoms, check it all out, because these symptoms you've having are probably due to some kind of catastrophic condition. You're just evading it. Come on, get moving. Call that doctor.
And, you know, and sometimes you wake it's like up you just feel it. Emotionally, it's like you feel it emotionally. You don't, sometimes I don't even hear it. I would feel it. Would feel it emotionally, like, oh man, that, you know, I might have had a sharp pain, you know, on the left side of my chest or something, and I'll be like, oh God, I'm gonna have a heart attack. And then, you know, you might have a pain go to your knee, and you're like, oh Lord, my knee's going out, you know, from all those old injuries playing football and wrestling, for in my case, and so forth, and you just get centered in there.
Well, I broke my heel in 1990, and I notice how, like when I got up this morning, I could feel in the broken area the pain. That heel is healed 20 years ago.
That's
and yet awesome. That pain is still in your brain.
Could it be something to do with the brain?
Yeah, it sure is. And I bet it's got a lot to do with TMS too. Because it keeps those pain memories alive.
So yes.
Probably the only way to get out of it, as I see it, is to change the biochemistry of your brain with meditation, and probably journaling does something similar too. And of course, working with a therapist would be have immeasurable value. But beginning about page 85, Steve Ozanich in this chapter 4 goes over the triggers that precede or coincide with the onset of TMS symptoms. And he talks about, let's see, what's one of these things? He talks about common triggers, an admonition. Yeah. That's where somebody walks up to you and admonishes you not to do something, like attending a course on RSI as a trigger. Then there are sensory triggers like the computer screen itself. And then there's a compassion trigger where someone feels sorry for you. And then there's a tremendous outpouring of all of the repressed emotion that you've had. And there's separation anxiety. And that's where the floodgate, Chuck was the example of someone with separation anxiety at the time of a rather bitter divorce. And
other than the parents, is the relationship the floodgates
of TMS open for Chuck at a kind word from a colleague, from a coworker. That was just enough to let the feeling start outpouring. Rushing out. He talks about another common trigger. Steve does a bump or a twist, which I could tell from my fall, which shouldn't have caused nearly as much pain as I suffered. And another is the empathetic trigger. I guess that's where somebody empathizes with you. And he says, Steve says that after the stressful period of life, I guess from 35 to 65, if someone winds up with TMS, it's what he calls the not so happy birthday, the aging trigger, which he says, yeah. Oh, I saw a guy yesterday with a unhappy birthday. I sent him a birthday card, and when I walked up to him to tell him I'd done it, he got a look like he was looking into the casket. I think it's 5-0. I'm not sure. It must be 5-0 from the look in his eye. He doesn't want anybody giving him a happy birthday.
At 5-0?
Yeah, he's always been worried about death and mortality and getting his before the curtains go down.
Uh-huh.
And every time somebody dies, I notice he's really afraid.
Wow.
It's funny how different people respond to that, you know?
Yeah.
It's like some matter-of-factly, and some it becomes a recurrent syndrome.
Do you think
reminds them of that.
Do you think the ultimate thought on immortality is just, you know, to come to acceptance with it and just be at peace with it? And I mean, if we can ever really get that, I haven't gotten it.
I know if I'm out in the Ionian Basin at 12,000 feet backpacking and I see the bone of a deer there, and I know that I'm going to be a bone someday, it doesn't bother me nearly as much as in society with a lot of mental gossip and real outright gossip going on around you.
What about the pictures in Syria? The way that, did you see the children?
Yeah, I could
is
watch
that not, while. Is that not a trigger? Just death? I mean, is that not, it's sad
well,
first.
Well, it's like war. Dr. Sarnoff says, after 9/11, the emergency rooms were flooded in the United States with people with mind-body symptoms for at least 2 weeks afterwards. They were all coming in with different things. Well, yeah, those pictures upset a lot of people. Their ground, what do they call that? The philosophic ground was undone. Their very structure of their life, the same way Pearl Harbor was for my parents' generation. You know, that really shook them up.
Yes.
The Japanese are coming. The Yamato is going to shell San Francisco. That night that the, right after Pearl Harbor, someone was playing over the intercom in downtown San Francisco the sound of London being bombed across the Atlantic. And people heard that. Edward R. Murrow broadcasting from London. And they could have these big speakers set up, and you could hear the crash and explosions over St. Paul's Cathedral and down in the East End. And people panicked. All over San Francisco, the Japanese were coming. This was maybe December 11th, right after Hitler declared war on the U.S. They were running all over the place until they finally realized it was only a recording. They had to
I'm
go
sure
around
they were it. Still shocked, you know, the freeze or the flight freeze, you know. Gosh, that probably
might have even killed some people. Enormous guns at the Golden Gate Bridge out on the Marine Headlands that were designed to counteract those huge guns of the Japanese battleships. They were built out there. They're still sitting there. You can go on tours. So it was very real there in December 1941. And people really panicked. And the same way
here, I would have been running.
I knew another guy, a soldier, a special forces guy, who was in one of those marches after 9/11. And someone, to be funny, took a string of firecrackers and threw them. And they started going off. People just scattered and ran. But he was a soldier, and he'd been in combat, and he knew they were just firecrackers. He knew they weren't bullets. So he just kept standing there and watching all the action go on. From the untrained, the unexperienced civilians.
That's sad.
And Steve talks about other triggers like ill loved ones, and pregnancy being a big one. Postpartum, when the additional responsibilities fall on the woman's shoulders. And she's supposed to like it, but inwardly, I'm sure she'd rather be at the junior prom and 16, you know, being the life of the party. And he talks about a guilt trigger, Steve does, and also about an examination trigger, where someone goes in to get tested for a bunch of things, and afterwards their symptoms flare up, because it seems to be confirming, you know. I guess it's more stress waiting for the examination results. I know that one, you know, when you're trying to call in to Kaiser to find out what the lab results are. Even with this little tick mite, I remember the tension. Oh, yeah, that's what I got when I got that tick bite. I had that examination trigger where I was waiting for the blood tests.
Yeah.
And that had to be an additional stressor on at that time.
Yeah, huge.
A huge, huge one. Yeah, they are.
That's a scary thought.
But anyway, that's my synopsis of what this chapter is about. It really is a time for reflection, as Steve entitles it. He's looking back at everything that happened up to the point where he first encountered Dr. Sarno and began to heal himself, going back over all of his symptoms and all of his trials and tribulations, and trying to see how these triggers had initiated his TMS symptoms. It's kind of like a time for soul searching, this chapter four, where he makes sense of it. So it's very important in terms of the overall design of the book.
Yes.
And of course, after this, I think we're going to be how I became pain free. We're going to see how he worked his way out of this pain, this painful life he had been living up to this point for 27 years, was it? Since his 14th birthday.
Yeah, 27 years. He just rounded it off to 30 years by then, which I'm sure you know. It took the he's probably still in the journey. He said he's healed all over his body, you know. But we are organic, so you know we will get a twinge here and there. It's a lot to do with how you react to that twinge, you know, or how you react to that trigger. So that's pretty powerful.
Yeah, well, I noticed that Steve also talks about he actually lists this Hoag Memorial Hospital Cleveland Clinic studies, which show that there is no correlation between spinal abnormalities and the appearance of lower back pain. I think that's if I remember correctly, that's the study where they gave MRIs and CT scans to 100 people off the street at random who had no back pain, and they found nearly 70% of them had spinal abnormalities, bulging discs, herniated discs, stenosis, scoliosis, all of these terms that Dr. Sarno lumps under spinal abnormalities. And then they took a second group of 100 people who had back pain and gave them the same MRIs and CT scans, and they found, to their surprise, I imagine, that nearly 70% of them had spinal abnormalities. And I know you look at this study and you look at the statistics, and it's been replicated a number of times, and you find that the only conclusion a rational person, you know, a post-Cartesian kind of scientific guy could reach, is that there is no relationship between abnormalities and lower back pain. It does not exist scientifically.
When I saw the, you know, the MRI of the back injury I had when I was just a kid at 15 years old, it was spondylolisthesis. I believe that's the way you pronounce it. That's the way I've always pronounced it. But when I looked at it, one of my vertebras was pushed probably, looked like 2 inches forward than the other vertebras. And I thought, and it just stuck in my head, you know, like a trigger. And it got conditioned over time, you know, thinking about it over and over and over. It was just there, like in the unconscious after that, like just pictures. And it was one scary thought to look at that and see it. But, you know, years later, that happened in a football accident, I thought. But I think it was like 20 years later that a doctor told me that I could have been born with that, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that's probably.
You get what I'm saying? Yeah. I could have been born with that, and here's the doctor pointing to this just ugly, you know, abnormality and saying, well, there's the problem. And well, I'm looking at it as a child, and I'm, you know, going to that freeze response.
Well, Alfred North had the head of the mathematics department at Harvard University in 1920, wrote a book called Science in the Modern World. And he criticizes Western civilization for having what he calls misplaced concreteness. And on misplaced concreteness on the visual icon. He's saying that ours is a visual culture. So, and we accept things that are shown to us in graphic format. So if you see that MRI of your bulging disc, you are going to grab onto that sucker and accept it as truth. And cause and effect, you're going to be just like Isaac Newton. It's going to be, you know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And
then the action would be you saw the picture and the reaction is pain.
Alfred North Whitehead talks about how we believe that matter is located in three-dimensional spatiotemporal coordinates on X, Y axes, which totally is contradicted by Einstein and quantum mechanics and Planck and Heidegger and all of these other people. But we still accept that. That's part of the visual icon is part of our common shared culture. It doesn't have anything to do with scientific truth. See, your observations may lead you to conclusions that are very much opposite of what the facts are.
Correct.
As Dr. Sarno noted. So.
Yes. Like the person with the bad shoulder, you know? Well, the doctor goes in there and does x-rays, and next thing you tell him he's got rotator cuff problems. He's telling him he's got a torn rotator cuff, frozen shoulder. And I don't know how you see that through an x-ray or if you can, or a normal person.
I had an MRI of my torn rotator cuff at Kaiser Hospital.
Did you actually see?
Yeah, I saw that one. No, I don't think I saw it. It went to the surgeon.
Yeah.
And the surgeon drew the conclusion that I needed an operation.
Yeah,
however,
and when they say that, you're like, well, you know, the pain's there. The doctor's saying it. So I feel it. So it's got to be, you know, physical. There ain't no way around it.
Well, this was at the same time that I also took that fall. And where was the pain located? In my left shoulder? Where was the pain? In my left butt. So it was part of the same complex. And I thought I'd pulled my muscle or tore my rotator cuff pressing to the left like that.
Yeah.
But when I went to my old doctor, he said, I'll put you through a range of motion, my standard range of motion tests. And I could hold my arm out like this. And he said, son, you don't have a totally catastrophic tear in your rotator cuff because you can't do this.
You can't hold your arm straight out.
Yeah, so he he was one of the best internists in the world, and he
That's
went
awesome.
By what he could see visually in the patient, not what was on the screen in the MRI. So they're itching to
Ooh.
Operate and make 20 grand. So
you've met a lot of blessed surgeons. You've met a lot of surgeons that just got it, right? I mean, obviously you've done mention two of them that just understood it and got it. Like you said,
old doctor understood it. The surgeon,
did you, your family?
I went to the surgeon and said, how can I hold my hand up like this if the rotator cuff is torn? Then she started getting all mad because she knew I'd gone out for a second opinion. And then she started weasel wording me. And a couple days later, the doctor said, if I were you, I wouldn't get that operation. And I called in like a good soldier and wouldn't go in. And he said, in about 6 weeks, it won't hurt as bad. And lo and behold, 6 weeks later, the pain completely disappeared. And my right arm, though a little bit weak, my left arm, though a little bit weaker, I don't know how much of that is TMS too, I have no problem with it whatsoever. I would have gone through a major shoulder surgery and 9 months convalescence if it hadn't been for him. I was getting, and I'm sure that it was at the same time all of these other things were occurring. I bet it's part of the same complex, the TMS complex. Part was my sciatica, part was initiated from the fall, part was the tear in the rotator cuff, which probably wasn't torn that bad, but I was feeling much, everything would set off more waves of pain. That's why you can't confuse pain with the need for the operation. I've heard with real good surgeons, they won't operate solely on the basis of pain, but from disability alone. You know, if there's something really wrong, they fix it with surgery. But if there's just pain, they're not just going to go in there and do a risky, invasive procedure like that lady was down at Kaiser. I'm so glad I said no.
The lady at Kaiser?
Yeah, the surgeon at Kaiser.
Yeah.
But they had it set up like a machine from their senior internist right over to the MRI and then right to her like I was being delivered. I got that feeling I was being railroaded too. Trust your gut reactions. I'd say that's true. You should listen to that voice inside and don't doubt because I was right.
You're right. You know, I had
How many of those operations do they do for rotator cuff? They don't have those hundreds of sheets explaining your operation for you if they're not doing an assembly line. If they're not doing it on an assembly line basis. It's a little moneymaker, I'd say.
Well, you know, for over 20 years of my life, you know, my right shoulder and my left shoulder, I always thought every time I'd start lifting something heavy I like to weight lift, and when I would do my benches and or raise my arms above my head, what would happen is I think I'd be laying like in bed and just roll over on my shoulder, and then all of a sudden I'd have this rotator cuff tear again. And in my mind it was like every time I get inch or every time I press weight over my head, then it wouldn't be there while I was working out. It was when I would come in and lay down and try to sleep, and I would always roll over on one shoulder or the other, and there was always the rotator cuff tear that came back, or so I thought, you know. And it would be like 6 weeks, 8 weeks before it even started feeling anywhere near better. And, now I know it was just TMS, because when I started studying TMS, I looked over at my shoulder. It was my right one. I just started back again on my bench pressing, and I looked over at my right shoulder, and it started hurting. And I told it to stop. And I believed actually in my head that was it. It was TMS, and it had to quit. And the pain stopped. And when the pain stopped, You know, now it don't work like that with all the pains. that I've had throughout my body, but with that shoulder, it did. And it was one of those aha moments, you know? And after that, it was like I could just tell it to stop, and it would. And it's pretty much left me alone now.
Don't you notice, Eric, that generally the pattern of like sciatica and lower back pain is that the pain does not occur during the activity itself, but afterwards? I think that's one of the classic characteristics of TMS. Like, you go for a walk, and while you're active, you don't feel anything. You get back in the car and you sit down, and all of a sudden your butt starts hurting and your knee starts hurting. And
yeah,
when
and if
you
it was
actually
real.
Are at rest, and that seems to correlate to that, what is it, phase four TMS that Steve Ozanich talks about, where it's the calm after the storm that the stuff manifests.
Do you got each one of those phases in, on your summary there, that maybe we can look at each phase?
That's way back in, is that chapter one where he talks about that?
I saw phase one was it can and does often occur where there is no structural damage. And he says phase one TMS, and that's on page 80.
Oh, here, they're on page 19 and 20. There's
he's got them on.
It's in the first chapter. He talks about phase one acute threshold TMS, where current high tension levels, no physical incident, acute rapid onset. Nothing happened. It just manifested that day. Then phase two is blood in the water, current high tension levels, physical trigger involved with lingering pain, like my fall out running, a physical trigger.
And that's pretty much, the trigger, okay.
Or I could think of whiplash as being akin to that, where somebody's under a bunch of tension driving their car and they get bumped. And then that's a trigger for the emotions to start pouring out, and then they have to repress them in using pain.
Well, you know, I remember we got bumped. Me and a brother-in-law of mine, we were going down the road into Atlanta, Georgia there, and a guy just comes up behind us and just bumps us a little bit. And my head went back, But by the time the paramedics had gotten there and had talked about whiplash to me so much and trying to get me to go to hospital, and by the time I'd went the next day to the doctor, and the way they had mentioned whiplash so many times, and by the time, even before I went to the doctor the next day, by the time my family got in a huddle around me and started talking about whiplash, I actually started hurting in my neck, to where that day I was telling them I'm fine, ain't nothing wrong with me, you know. This was when I was in my early 20s, but actually, the more I heard about it, the next day before I got to the doctor, I was hurting. I was actually feeling physical pain in my neck, and I knew that bump couldn't have been enough to have done, you know, that much damage. But what was scaring me was, now I'm getting pain here. And the thing
that's like a lingua franca, a common language in our culture, is knowledge about whiplash. So anytime somebody is hit, then everybody starts spewing all of this knowledge they have about whiplash into your ear. And if that isn't conditioning, I don't know what is. That's like making you expect these symptoms to start manifesting. Then he has phase three, which he calls backdoor TMS. You have current high tension levels, and a old injury seemingly resurfaces. Like this morning, feeling my broken heel when I got up.
Yeah.
It's tricky, because now I'm not listening to the clicks in my spine when I put my pants on anymore. Now it decides to go down into my foot to remind me, or to make me conscious of its presence there. It's real tricky that way, isn't it?
Well, I've had an imperative moving all around my body for the last two, three weeks now. And, you know, we get to a point where we're totally healed. And that's what happened with me. And but I, you go through certain things in life where you're going to have these pains, you know, jump up here and there. And as soon as I look at one and I'll use focusing or meditation, some type of soothing, and it leaves, say the tension is still around me or whatever was the trigger, it's still a trigger and I haven't focused on solving that trigger solution, you know, then it'll just move in my body to somewhere else. I really, what happened to me was I went to the doctor and they told me I had Rocky Mountain tick fever, and talk about, you know, some a battle, you know, this week is, or the past 2 weeks really, it's been a battle. The thing is, the biggest battle I would assume is in the mind. It always has been and everything, when it comes to fevers and stuff like that. And I'm not saying that fever's a TMS at all. But at the same time, with my understanding of don't panic, keep it under control, you know, meditate, calm yourself, you know, all kinds of, I've been breaking out the whole two bag these last 2 weeks on this. And here I am tonight, and I'm almost recovered. Almost.
Well, I noticed that when I was bit by a tick this last March, I was so conditioned to expect, Lyme disease or some kind of infection, that when I rushed down to ER, and it just took off on its own without anything. My blood test came back clean. I had a high white cell count indicative of no infection. All of this, but then everything started taking off. My blood pressure rose. I got a rash on my back. Then the rash wouldn't go away and it kept going on. And then I realized that, when did I get the tick bite? It was on the day of the anniversary of my father's death. And studying this stuff, from other people's experience, you can see, aha, that's what was going on. That was the tick bite provided you with a distraction from the feelings associated with your father's death. So you could invest everything in this symptomology and have all the rash finally went away after about a month. And what was it? It was nothing. It was totally a reaction to the tick bite. And that never did anything.
Did you get the feeling warm? Did you ever get the feeling warm thinking, you know, I might have a fever or anything like that?
No, I never did have anything. It was more like a unlocking the door of a haunted house and entering into it. I noticed it was like about a month and a half till what solved it? Resolving that, what was it, cognitive dissonance? I took my camera and went up and took pictures of the new tiger cub at SF State, at San Francisco Zoo, at the and the Flyshacker Zoo. And what I realized I was doing was I was walking in my father's shoes when he used to go up there with me with a camera. It was like I was compelled to do it. It was like a psychodrama. And then the symptoms went away. I was making peace with Dad. But
that's awesome.
To read thing, to get to the stage where you can read this psychic topography, like one of those Aborigines in Australia who lives their dream life, that's what it takes to heal, to get in touch with your inner feelings. And aren't we confused with the visual icon, with the MRI, with all of this stuff? It really takes you off the track. I was reading in a forum today, a guy who's starting to have back pain. And the first thing he does is write in and he's looking for a orthopedic surgeon.
Uh-huh.
First thing, you know, this is like hits his mind right away. I've got to have an operation. And this may not be the case at all. It could be, I bet it's TMS. I bet this guy's a hard-driven, perfectionist, overachieving athlete, and now he's got this condition, and he wants to solve it with the knife by physical means. He wants to solve a psychological problem using physical, visual tools from the scientific cabinet. And that's the first thing that enters his mind. And I want to tell him that no surgeon's going to operate on you for just pain. They've got to be, you know. But I think a lot of that is being done myself. I think people just jump on that surgery bandwagon when they have back pain. I've run into all kinds of people recovering around the gym who walked up to me and said, well, I'm just recovering from spinal surgery. And I happen to know this guy had just had a divorce and lost his house. And I didn't want to say, maybe you should be looking at this divorce and the loss of the house and the loss of your job before you go running to the surgeon to get your spine trimmed.
No, you just want to grab some people and just tell them the truth. But, you know, until they hear it, until they understand it, until they know it for themselves or seek it out, in other words, for themselves, it's almost impossible.
I know. I think it's like you could stumble across it yourself if you were open.
And we feel sorry for them, you know? I mean, I see them and I feel so sorry for them because, like you said, they're saying everything and they're even telling you all the triggers. They're telling you everything that led up to it, but they don't hear it. But you do.
I looked at this guy. He's not happy.
Yeah.
You can tell he's not happy. I knew him 10 years ago and he's all confident. He's got a new kid. He's just got married. He's bought a house. He's just grinning ear to ear. Now there's a cloud over his head. He's walking down a dark path. And sure, you're going to get symptoms if you're like that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I bet everybody does to a degree.
Well, you know, that part where we show the world, and then that part that's really us, you know, and I think that was in last week's study, but I think we have to, the part that's really us, I think when we can free that part up and let it out, it really constitutes to take us a long way in healing. What do you think?
If you can open up the doors to that other way of seeing, that other way of perceiving your emotional life, as being related to your symptomology, making the connections. I was walking around the gym the other day and it was really crowded and I started noticing pain in my knee. And I thought about it a while and I said to myself, when did you feel odd and out of place in a crowd? Probably in seventh grade out on the playground when you were being picked on. So when it gets crowded like that, then I feel like my ego's on the line and I'm vulnerable and I want to cover up.
And you put that together.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think that's awesome. Mindfulness meditation is the way. Because once you start feeling your emotions in the various areas of your body, you can make those connections.
Would that be like focusing when you said mindfulness meditation? I think it, you know, the way you describe, you know, how you do it, it sounds like, you know, the way Eugene Genlin does it. And since I've learned, you know, focusing, it's really helped me a lot.
You have that methodology down too. What did you call that? Not mindfulness meditation. You have a feeling, empathetic feeling in your body some way.
Like when others, somatic experiencing?
Yes, exactly. That sounds like another name for the same thing.
Yes, same thing as focusing.
Well, it's like where you move your consciousness through your feet, your calves, your lower leg, your hips, your back, your stomach, your lungs, your heart, your shoulders. You start to be able to move it like a dial. You develop that skill. And so when you're having a problem, you can move your mind in there and see what it is. What are you feeling right now? What is this?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, it's not just pain. It's some kind of awkwardness. Cognitive dissonance. You're identifying the source of cognitive dissonance, the place, the location.
It's a powerful tool. It's a powerful tool that I believe now maybe 4 months that I've known it. And before, you know, I wouldn't have never, unless I was here and learn it through a TMS Wiki, and everybody else talking about it, I believe it would have passed me by.
Yeah, I noticed too that a lot of obsessiveness has left me as I practice mindfulness. When I see external things that I could be jumping on and getting involved with, like I used to, I just let them pass by.
Was it through mindfulness? Was it through mindfulness?
Maybe it's a corollary. Maybe it's a corollary to the experience, to the other process. Maybe it's a separate process. I don't know. But it seems like the level of obsessiveness goes down as you become more mindful about your inner emotional life. You're not reaching out for externals so much. On to them and trying to really, you know, work them to death. You can walk by instead of just grabbing at every little detail and trying to make it into a big deal.
Where did you get that from? I like that. You can walk by rather than looking at every detail. That's awesome. Is that your original?
Yeah, that's original.
That's awesome, Bruce.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah, you can walk on by. Well, when you start realizing you've been doing this and it's led to, outcomes that are not useful or productive, non-productive outcomes, you don't need to do it. I think that's why some people go along getting into fights all day long, isn't it?
I think so, you know. Wow.
It distracts them from their fundamental anger inside, and it's a lot easier to get involved in the minute particulars and fussing and fighting with individuals than to actually address that stuff inside.
You know, I have a sister that, you know, she'll get mad, and she's always letting people, you know her feelings, and she's... if it's time to cry, she'll cry. She doesn't hold anything back. And I've never seen, she's 44 now. I've never heard her in pain. She's doing a lot of releasing, I would assume.
Yeah. It's like someone said, my father was the kind of guy who gave other people high blood pressure. who were around him, because he let it all out. He never held back. He never had any problems like that.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Does anybody want to say anything about a trigger they might have before we end the night discussion that me and Bruce could help you with or talk to you about? Okay. Well, it's 10 o'clock now, so we're going to go ahead and cut it off. It's the end of the show. And I believe pretty much Bruce summed it up when he started talking about the triggers and conditionings. And there's so much out there. I even watched a show one time where a girl just a color would make her hurt. Looking at certain colors made her hurt. So there's this we could talk about this, I believe, pretty much from this day to the rest of the year and still not even tap all the triggers and conditionings that's out there. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think like, look at what Steve talks about, where the color of the computer screen can function as a trigger for RSI, where someone focuses on it all the time, where it gets to be obsessive compulsive. Yeah, but the problem is their personality type, not the medium that they're working in.
Yes, it's not the color.
Yeah.
But then again, after a while, I guess it could be conditioned as a color, huh?
Yeah, well, I think Dr. Sarno says somewhere that anything can be a trigger. The lists are endless. And it depends on what you're obsessive about or what you have to have the emotions built up and for the trigger to set them off.
I guess one of the ultimate triggers that of our day could be allergies, huh? I mean, somebody sees, now I'm not talking about, you know, deathly stuff. I'm talking about where somebody sees a cat and not a cat. I can't say that, but somebody sees pollen and all of a sudden they start feeling bad, getting the sniffles and, you know, and then the next thing you know, they say they're allergic to it. That might be the case. Then again, it could be pretty much conditioning. What do you think?
Well,
that's pretty
Someone
far out there
me
when you
a
mentioned
long,
that.
A long time ago, a scientist up at Washington that allergies were emotional. And I wanted to debate with him. I said, oh no, I inhaling this pollen and then I'm having this chain of reactions. But he said, oh no, no. You know, I can see what he meant was that it's a program. Well, what causes allergies? A hyperactive autoimmune system. Mm. What causes the autoimmune system to become hyper?
Tension.
Stress.
Yeah.
Tension. Probably what Steve would call cognitive dissonance. That kind of tension inside. And I think you will find that people develop allergies at that point where in childhood where there's some, I bet they do more often in families where there's some kind of internal conflict between parents and the kid takes it on and that affects his autoimmune system and then he starts reacting and then there must be some kind of reinforcement where they pay attention to him for getting sick and that's what he's crying for anyway. So having an allergic condition is a way to get love from mom and dad.
That's correct. That's,
Well, sickness can be like that too, getting a bunch of colds, because then mom comes in with the chicken soup, you know?
Even pain, physical pain can serve as the same thing, you know? I mean, you always, you know, took care of the family and all of a sudden something, maybe you and your wife start arguing or something and you want more attention from her. And then all of a sudden, TMS gives you a good back pain, lays you down in the bed. And you're like, well, what's going on here? You know? Wow, it can go so far out there, Bruce.
This stuff is just
endless. It is. We can speak about it all night, you know? But I'm going to go ahead and end the recording. I want to let everyone know, next week we'll be discussing Chapter 5, How I Became Pain-Free. I know that's going to be an awesome chapter there. Wouldn't you agree, Bruce?
Yeah, well, that's where he really does it, where Steve really does it. All this has been a lead up to that.
Yeah.
He's laid the theoretical groundwork. He's given his biography. He's talked about triggers and the genesis of pain at a point where you're under stress. And now he's going to show you how to fix it, how
awesome.
He fixed it.
Well, that's going to be good for tune in next week. And guys, I want everybody to know we really appreciate y'all showing up tonight. And we'll be seeing y'all next week.
Thanks a lot.
As a country. Sir?
I just said thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you. Is this Kyle?
Yep.
All right, brother. God bless y'all and have a good night.